Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to the Tax Resolution Institute's Practitioners Forum, part of our Tax Tuesdays series. As a reminder, our Practitioners Forum happens every first Tuesday of the month, and our next call will be on September 5th, so please mark your calendars. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone how this call is going to work. If you can hear the sound of my voice, then that means that you have logged in correctly. On today's call, we have a great turnout, and I can assume it's because we missed last month due to the holiday, but we do expect more than 150 participants. Because of this, we asked for questions to be submitted via email, and a lot of you did respond. After we answer those questions, and time permitting, we will open it up to the rest of you on the line. We will announce when the Q&A session has begun and ask that you please type in the questions box your name as you entered it while logging onto the call and that you have a question. We will then unmute you when we call upon you to ask your question. We will select participants in the order that when you submitted your name in the question box. Once we unmute you, you will be prompted by the system that you have been unmuted, and you will now be able to speak for all of us to hear. Now, some of you, I understand, are shy, so you can also go ahead and type in your question in the questions box, and I'll just read it out loud. Now that we got that out of the way, let's go ahead and begin. If you've been attending the previous practitioners forum calls, you've noticed that we had the head of our legal department, Norman Kreisman. But today we have Peter Steffen, the founder of the Tax Resolution Institute, joining us today. So most of you will recognize Peter as our presenter and instructor of our many seminars and webinars found on our website at taxresolutioninstitute.org. Peter is qualified by the Board of Accountancy in all states, the Internal Revenue Service, the State Bar of California, State Bar of New York, and several other states. To provide continuing professional education to attorneys, CPAs, and enrolled agents in the area of tax resolution. Peter has authored the textbook, The Ultimate Guide to Tax Resolution, as well as several tax resolution manuals providing fellow professionals with one-of-a-kind instruction, allowing them to resolve all types of tax resolution issues. Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you Peter Steffen.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Thanks for the introduction, Joe. Welcome again to our Tax Practitioners Forum. I want to remind you that that every Tuesday we have something going on at 10 o'clock Pacific Standard Time. Don't forget to check out your emails for whatever the current Tuesday deal is. On the first Tuesday, as I said, we have this practitioners forum. Typically, we get somewhere north of 100 people attending, so we try to get to as many questions as possible. On the second Tuesday, we have a lightning deal. Think Amazon if you have to, but we give away a free webinar, free e-learning, or something that is going to up your game in the area of tax or tax controversy. On the third Tuesday, we do a featured broadcast, sometimes live, sometimes pre-recorded. Some of our most popular courses are done on that third Tuesday, and they're free. By way of example, we have our most popular course, Offers in Compromise and Installment Agreements. We have low-hanging fruit, half dozen ways to make money tomorrow in the tax controversy business. If you haven't checked that one out, it is a must attend. And then, of course, the fourth Tuesday, we have another lightning deal. So the bottom line, free, 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 and free every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific time. All right, enough on that. Again, my name is Peter Steffen. I'm the author of the book, The Ultimate Guide to Tax Resolution. I leave it on my desk as my reference guide. We're going to make you a special deal on the book today, but we'll talk about that later. Joe, let's get to the questions so that we get this show on the road here today.
Thank you, Peter. As a reminder to all of you who are attending, the subscribers do get priority on these practitioners forum call, so we are taking the first few here that are from subscribers. First one is from Fred. His question is, I am taking on my first trust fund recovery penalty case and getting ready for a 4180 interview. The IRS wants to meet with the owners and the payroll manager. The payroll manager is just an employee and does not have an ownership interest in the corporation. Is there a quick way to keep the IRS from focusing on him?
All right, good question, Fred. And before I answer it, let me just say that when Norman takes these calls on some of our Tuesdays. Norman's a tax lawyer. You ask him a question, he gives you an answer. I do it a little bit differently. I'm going to give you the answer, but I'm also going to show you and tell you how to make money doing this kind of work. And that's what happens in our low-hanging fruit course. I show you how to make money because that's what we're really here for. You know, we're here to teach you how to make more money, how to work with you on your tax resolution clients if it's past your pay grade or knowledge level, or to become your trusted referral source. So let me get to this question because it's a good one, and there's actually a lot of money in this for those of you practicing in this area. I'm going to tell you why in a moment. When you have a payroll tax liability, typically what happens is this. You're looking for an installment agreement, and as part and parcel to the installment agreement, the IRS revenue officer, remember, collection revenue officers, audit revenue agents, the collection officer is going to conduct what we call the 4180 interview. What this 4180 interview is, and 4180 is just the name of the form. By the way, you can't find it at irs.gov. Go to taxresolutioninstitute.org and pick up the form there. And what this 4180 interview is a face-to-face interview. 95% of the time, the revenue officers will not agree to do it on the telephone unless it's a very simple, almost lay-down case, and because they're looking to find people that they can hold responsible for the trust fund portion of the payroll tax liability. So let's back up for a second. For those of you who don't practice in this area or have a limited experience, we know that payroll taxes come in four parts, you know, when they're delinquent. We have the trust fund portion of the liability, which is the amount you withhold from people's pay. We have the non-trust fund portion of the liability. That's the matching share of Social Security and Medicare. Then we have the penalties and the interest. Those are the four parts. Of course, we have the interest on the penalties, but we're just going to call that penalties and interest. So trust fund, non-trust fund, penalties, and interest. So the revenue officer shows up, comes to your conference rooms, comes to your client's place of business, and sits across from the client and perhaps the bookkeeper and anybody else that the revenue officer might think could be tagged as a responsible person. And they ask questions like, who authorized the payroll? How did you do the payroll? Was it through paychecks? Was it through, what did you do it internally? Do you do it through QuickBooks? Who's responsible? Did you pay someone else, meaning even the rent or next time's net payroll, when you knew there was a payroll tax liability outstanding? It's a very low threshold here to become the responsible person. So you know, typically, what happens is the revenue officer starts with the bank signature card. Excuse me, we have a little background noise here I'm trying to take care of. Now, please. Okay, sorry about that, everyone. Just a little distracting on my end. So the IRS will meet with the owner, the payroll manager, and anybody that the starting point, as I said, is the bank signature card. After they ask these questions, they're going to try to get as many people as possible as responsible persons. Why? Because they're all jointly and severally liable. Now, just like a partnership, what you have to remember is, as CPAs, EAs, or lawyers, you can be held responsible. So be careful about the advice that you give to your clients, because it's going to come out in this 4180 interview. So now let's back up and talk about how to handle a 4180 interview. I'm going to spend a little more time on this than I usually do on these questions because it's so important, and it's a way for you all to make money. The reason, okay, so each 4180 interview is going to take you a couple of hours to prepare your client so they don't say something silly, so they don't accidentally implicate more than one or two people. Of course, some of them want to do that, but it's my opinion that the fewer people that are tagged as the responsible persons, meaning that they're personally liable, the better. So the fewer, the better. Now, why do I say that? Because if they're assessed, if more than one person is assessed the trust fund recovery penalty, what happens? The price of admission goes up because you have to do installment agreements for two people. You have to worry about the hit on their credit. You have to worry about perhaps two offers in compromise or three or four rather than one. So depending on the circumstances, less is better. Now, how do you do that? You do that by preparing your clients. For example, you might have a client who's the inside person who authorizes the payroll, who signs the checks, and an outside person who's on the road most of the time selling. You might want to just have the one person assessed. Of course, that's a whole partnership issue and shareholder issue, and you could have other considerations, but less is more in this instance for your client. So try to do the right thing for your client. By the way, if they go the other way, you just make more money. But that's not our preference. So prepare them for the 4180 interview. That's a couple of hours. The 4180 interview typically takes 2 to 4 hours. And then the wrap-up takes about an hour or more. So as you can see, you have 6 or 8 billable hours for each 4180 interview, and multiply that by your rate, and you can see why I call it low-hanging fruit in our low-hanging fruit seminar. It's just one of the ways to make money in this business, and it's not a very difficult interview. It's not a very difficult prep for the client. So if you're not doing this kind of work, I recommend you get up to speed, and we'll talk about how you do that a little bit later here in the course. So there is a way to keep the IRS from focusing on employees that don't have an ownership interest, but only if you prepare your clients properly. Most owners of the company don't want their bookkeeper to be assessed the trust fund recovery penalty. The bookkeeper, by and large, usually isn't the person who is making the decisions as not to pay the payroll taxes, although I just had a situation with a client whose bookkeeper did exactly that, and the client was surprised and wanted to shoot the messenger, which was us. Of course, you know that we do traditional accounting work here as well. And so we see this happening all the time. Hope that answers your question. Hope that shows you how much opportunity there is here, not only for you, but for your clients to get off the hook by properly handling the trust fund recovery penalty case and the preliminary at the 4180 interview. Joe, next question.
Thank you, Peter. I'm going to go off schedule here just because Tom is asking a question online now related to your answer now. He's also asking, if a payroll service receives the hours and other payroll info and simply runs the work, could they be held responsible?
The answer to that question, Tom, is probably not. They're just the mechanics. In fact, what happens is when paychecks or any other payroll service, and by the way, if you have clients that need a payroll service, check us out at taxresolutioninstitute.org. We have a special deal with paychecks where you can make money and your client can get discounted fees. Excuse me, so check that out. What happens with these payroll companies is that you have a choice going in. They debit your account for the net payroll, obviously, or they just prepare your payroll, or they debit your account for the net payroll and the payroll taxes. The minute you bounce one debit, they're going to throw you overboard, and they will not be responsible for the payroll tax deposits, and that's why they'll actually discontinue doing your payroll if you do it a couple of times. So I hope that answers your question. They will not be the responsible persons.
Thank you, Peter. Okay, so moving on to Nate is our next question. Nate is asking, and again, he's a subscriber. My client just recently acquired a home healthcare business that had outstanding payroll tax liability. Previous owners have not been assessed, and I'm trying to negotiate a payment plan. The IRS wants to interview both the new owner and the old owner. Do I have a chance of having the IRS assess the new owner only? The business has the potential of being very profitable, so the new owner wants to contain the liability so she doesn't have to give up anything if the IRS assesses the previous owner personally.
Interesting question. We've had cases like this, and I'll tell you what the result is. The IRS is going to interview anyone that they feel could be a responsible person. So the simple answer to the first part of the question is yes. They're going to interview the old owner and the new owner. We have a couple of issues here. One is the trust fund recovery penalty. So theoretically, the pre-business sale owner is going to be assessed that portion of the trust fund recovery penalty that I'm assuming he was the responsible person on. There could also be other responsible persons there as well, but you'll have to just wait and see how many people the IRS decides to do the 4180 interview with. Now, let's get to the new person. We have two different issues here. One is the assessment of the trust fund recovery penalty against the new owner, and the IRS can't assess the trust fund recovery penalty from the pre-purchase or the pre-sale by the old owner against the new owner. However, if additional payroll taxes accrued, and we have a case where in our office right now where we had pre and post, they can assess the trust fund recovery penalty against the new owner for the post-purchase trust fund taxes. Now, because there's successor liability, that is, the new owner bought the company subject to the liabilities. This wasn't an asset sale or something like that. They just bought the stock. The corporation is going to be liable for the entire liability, the liability of the old owner and the new owner and the non-trust portion, the interest, and the penalties. So if it were me orchestrating a sale or a purchase of this business, I would definitely not have made it a stock purchase because we have successor liability when you do it that way. So hopefully that answered your question on that. So for the old owner can be assessed for the old liability. The new owner can be assessed for the new liability, the trust fund portion. Joe?
All right, Peter, thank you. So Ashley is asking, client had an audit for tax year 2014 and ignored the notices. She has now received collection notices for tax due, notice of intent to levy has been issued, and not sure if we can appeal the audit now. Looking at the original request for information, it seems like we can prove at least some of the expenses they were looking at. What are my options?
Okay, we see this all the time. Client thought the CPA was handling the audit, and the CPA went MIA. The client said they didn't get the notices, and the IRS issued the 30-day letter, disallowed all the deductions, because that's what they do. Then they issued the 90-day letter, which, of course, gives you the opportunity to petition the tax court, and that was ignored as well. And now several years have gone by, and it's out of the assessment area, meaning that a revenue agent is not handling this anymore. They've sent the 30-day letter, which is the time that you have to provide this information. If you don't show for the audit, it sends a 90-day letter, which is the time, the second bite at the apple, if you will. And now it's over in collection. So revenue agents add income, throw away deductions. Revenue officers don't care about any of that. Revenue officers are the collectors. It's probably not a big leap to figure out who's more aggressive. So the question is, what am I going to do? I know that he had more. I know that he had mortgage interest. I know we can prove that, but the IRS disallowed it. I know that he had Schedule C expenses, like rent and telephone. I mean, at very least, but the IRS threw those out too. Why? Because the taxpayer no-showed for the audit. So what do I do now? Well, first of all, you've got a problem because you're going to need to put some kind of hold on the collection activity. So the taxpayer just made it more complicated for you, read more expensive. So what you do is you try to get the revenue officer to put a hold on collection activity for some period of time. It's probably not going to be enough time. You may have to do a collection information statement, a 433A, a 433B, a 433F, or something like that. Usually when it's with a revenue officer, you do a 433A. If it's with ACS, you do a 433F. This is a collection information statement. Try to get your client, if they won't put a hold on collection activity, try to get them put in what we call CNC status, currently non-collectible status. If you can't do that, get them a small dollar installment agreement. It will prevent enforced collection activity. Bank levies, wage garnishments, third party levies, things like that. All the worst of all worlds. Now, back to the audit side. What do? I know I can substantiate some of the expenses. We know that the client just ignored the notices. So you have two choices here. You ask for an audit reconsideration, and even after the three-year statute of limitations has expired, you will get an audit reconsideration. One of the things that we've noticed and one of the strategies that we use here at the Tax Resolution Institute is we sometimes prepare and file an offer in compromise, doubt as to liability. Let's back up for a second. Remember, there are three types of offers. Doubt as to collectability, I owe it and can't pay. Doubt as to liability, I've never owed the money, why am I being assessed? And effective tax administration, which we won't talk about because they're few and far between. So sometimes what we do is we file that doubt as to liability offer. It's actually very simple. It's not, it's a half hour job. And it ends up as an audit reconsideration anyway. So why would you do it? We find that you get an audit reconsideration quicker than you generally do when you just straight out asked for the audit reconsideration. I don't know why that is, but that's our experience here at the Tax Resolution Institute. So audit reconsideration or offering compromise, doubt as to liability are your two options. Next, Joe.
All right, now next one is from Bruce. Bruce says, I submitted an individual income tax offer over a year ago, and I've been going back and forth with the offer specialist about expenses on a 1065 for a business that was owned by the client last year, but he sold it this year. Looks like the specialist is disallowing some of the expenses, therefore increasing the client's personal income and then determining he can full pay the tax liability and declining the offer. Have you seen this before? Can I appeal the decision? How can the offer specialist disallow expenses on a 1065 return?
You know, Bruce, that's an interesting question, and we're just starting to see more of that now here at TRI. All of a sudden, revenue officers, 95% of which don't know anything about assessment, as opposed to revenue agents, 95% of which don't know anything about collection, are now getting further in to the Schedule C's on tax returns and asking to substantiate expenses on the 1120 S's and on the partnership returns. This is something that's pretty new out there, because typically unless it was some egregious or something jumped out and bit them, they would take these flow-through entities or Schedule C information pretty much at the face. So they're getting more into this examination of the expenses to try to increase income. What I'm saying is the revenue officers at some level are starting to act like revenue agents. And it's a little bit scary because it's a lot more work for us when we try to do an installment agreement or an offer and compromise. So on this partnership issue, I think what you need to explain to the revenue officer is that, and there are a couple of issues here. One is that the taxpayer is no longer involved in the partnership, and it's a little vague here that the partnership was sold. If the partnership was sold, the revenue officer could take the position that it's a dissipated asset and it belongs to the IRS. But assuming it was sold for a nominal amount or just liquidated, you shouldn't have an issue here, and you have to focus the revenue officer on current events. Remember, the amount of the liability does not drive the payment amount. That is, the amount of the payment is not predicated on the liability. We could have a taxpayer that made $1 million last year because they were in the mortgage broker business in 2007 or 8. And we've had a case just like that. And the following year, they're working at Home Depot or McDonald's. The payment amount is based on current events. So if your client has a change in circumstance, you need to point this out to the revenue officer, because talking about last year's partnership has nothing to do with this year's events. Remember, again, the payment is not predicated on the liability. It's predicated on the ability to pay. Next, Joe.
All right, moving on to Kelly. Kelly is asking, a prospective client claims he has not filed returns in about 20 years. His fiance has made him come to his senses and refuses to marry him unless he takes care of this and becomes a normal taxpaying citizen. Talk about motivation. My questions are, do we have to prepare all unfiled returns? And two, where do we begin to gather income information? He's held several jobs throughout this time and does not have records. I think transcripts that can only get the last 6 to 7 years of wage and income. Your guidance is appreciated.
Well, this is always a tough question, you know, when returns haven't been filed in so long. There's no right answer. There's no good answer. We've asked revenue agents, we've asked revenue officers, and typically the answer is file the last 7 years tax returns. We try to file as many as we can, but remember, and we've never seen this happen, but remember, there's no statute of limitations for failure to file. So theoretically, the IRS could come back one day and say, file the returns from 10, 20 years ago. As a practical matter, this is not what we see happen. Typically, we're going to file 7 to 10 years returns, normally 7, and then we're going to see if the IRS comes back and asks for more returns. We haven't seen them do that, but it's certainly possible, because things change quickly at the IRS, and that's why it's important for those of you who don't do a lot of work in this area to remember that it's very hard, like anything else, to one-off this kind of work, because things change so quickly. If you're not on the phone and dealing with the IRS or even the state agencies, whether it be the sales tax people, the payroll tax people, the income tax people, or the IRS on the state or federal level, things change fast enough that you need to be doing this work every day in order to know what's going on, because you're not going to find all of this in the IRM. Speaking of IRM, let me make a quick a comment there. For those of you who don't know, collection is covered in Section 5 of the IRM. So for those of you who haven't done it, I go to any search engine, type in irs.gov. When you get to the IRS website, type in IRM in the search box and go to Section 5. Many, many years ago, I had a revenue officer quote me the Internal Revenue Manual, and I was kind of sort of embarrassed. But I decided that was never going to happen to me again. So twice a week, three times a week, for a couple of years, I'd go home at night and read Section 5 of the IRM for about 15 or 20 minutes. And I got to a point where I could quote the IRM to the revenue officers on the phone, and as you might suspect, they didn't know what was in the IRM. And it's a very effective way to deal with revenue officers who, most of which are not as up to speed as that. We're getting some questions here on, and they go something like this. Oh my gosh, I didn't know there was so much involved in some of these areas. You talked about 4180 interviews. You talked a little bit about installment agreements and your, you know, 1 hour webinars and Tax Tuesdays and like that. So, but where do we get more information? How do we get way up to speed on this work? We do several 8 hour seminars a year. They're live seminars and live broadcasts. So we have one coming up here in Woodland Hills, California, on August 23rd, which is live and webcast at the same time. It qualifies for 8 hours of continuing professional education for CPAs, for enrolled agents, and for lawyers. We also broadcast it if you're out of state or you're too far. And for those of you attending the call today, we make a deal for the Tax Tuesday people. If you come to the webcast, the cost is $149. We send you a textbook, a copy of our textbook, The Ultimate Guide to Tax Resolution, at no charge. Typically, we sell that for $149, so your net cost is zero. This is only for people that attend Tax Tuesdays. For those of you who come live to the seminar, we sell it at a discounted price of $249. And again, we give you a copy of the textbook, not a PDF, the actual textbook. It's about 400 or 500 pages. I use it on my desk as my reference guide every day. So the $249 turns into about $100 net cost. This is the seminar is on the 23rd of August, seminar and webcast. We have a rebroadcast on the 29th and 30th, live and online, because we have people in the Midwest and the East Coast wanting to attend, and because of the time zones, we've decided to make it more convenient for them. So if you cannot make the live seminar, we do have other dates on the 29th and 30th. If you have any questions, go to taxresolutioninstitute.org or feel free to pick up the phone and call Joe here at the Tax Resolution Institute.
I'm also going to go ahead and be sending a link now so you guys will see it there too. So that's one thing that I'll push now.
When you sign up for the seminar, in addition, you're going to get a 10% discount on the course itself. But you must use promo code, write this down, FORUM10, F-O-R-U-M-10. Joe's going to push out a link to you to remind you. But again, if you have any difficulty or any confusion, feel free. Pick up the phone, call Joe here at the Tax Resolution Institute, and let's move on.
All right, Peter, thank you very much for that. Next question is from Irving. Irving is asking, if a taxpayer had a substitute for return prepared and the IRS is now collecting, should I still file the return? It doesn't look like filing the return will change his liability at all. Any pros or cons?
That's a really good question because, as you all know, at some point in time, when the taxpayer is non-responsive, the IRS files a return called an SFR, a substitute for return. How do they do it? Well, lots of ways. They might start with information that was provided to them by third parties. So, for example, they'll have W-2 information. They might have 1099 information. And in this particular case, the substitute for return is about the same as the return would be if they filed it, filed a delinquent return. So you have some pros and cons there. The pros are, well, it's about the same, and if he's going to pay the tax liability anyway, not that big a deal. You probably don't really need to file the return, although generally that's not recommended. The cons are very simple. These SFRs, and this is still not completely settled, have been through the several courts, the Fifth Circuit, the Ninth Circuit, and are not dischargeable in bankruptcy. So you have to be very careful. We're going to talk about bankruptcy in a moment because I see a question coming through that came through, and we're going to talk about the bankruptcy dischargeability rules in a minute or two. So the cons are, be very careful if you have SFRs, because they will not be dischargeable in bankruptcy. So my recommendation is, even if the SFR is close to the amount, you probably should file the actual return. Let me give you one more con, though. The filing of the SFR, which typically happens a couple of years after the due date of the original tax return, may be so far in the past that the 10-year statute has run 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years already by the time the case lands on your desk. In a situation like that, you probably do not want to file an original return. Also, remember, we're not talking about state today, but I need to throw this in, and you'll hear this at the live seminar and webcast. If you file a return, you're going to start that statute over again. If you make a payment, for example, to the state, that statute will start over again. Be very careful. I've had situations where taxpayers have, the state statute of limitations is 20 years generally. IRS is 10 years. I've had situations where the state reps have persuaded taxpayers that are 15, 16 years into the statute to make small payments, $25, $100. It starts the statute, the collection statute over. Be very, very careful. You don't commit malpractice in this area. So hopefully that was a long-winded but answer to your question. Joe, let's get the next one because we're actually going to run out of time here today.
Okay, Rachel's asking, I have a tax client that files married filing separate every year, and her husband does the same. This year, it looks like she will owe more than usual and will not be able to pay it, approximately $90,000. I think I will have to prepare financials to arrange a payment plan. Will her husband's income play a role in this? Can we keep him out?
The answer is they're joint and severally liable. They're married filing separate, but depending on the state that they live in, the answer is going to be different. So if they're truly married filing separate and they're not in a community property state, then you can probably keep the income out of the collection information statement. The problem is that the IRS, if they even allow that, will only allow half the expenses. So they're going to get you either on the top line or the bottom line. If you're in a community property state, we all know that even married filing separate, I'll put a twist to all this in a moment, give me a second here. We all know that married filing separate, the proper way to prepare a tax return in a married filing separate tax return in a community property state is to take the community income, divide it in half, and put half on each of the returns. So you take the W-2, you cut it in half, you put it half on the husband's return, half on the wife's return, and so on and so forth. So it kind of depends on what state you live in. I think there are 10 community property states. I might be wrong there, but easy enough to look up. Can you keep the husband out? Well, if it truly is a married filing separate situation, one of the things the IRS is going to be looking for is a prenup. In addition, segregation of funds. If they commingle funds, it's going to be harder to keep them out. That doesn't mean that they can't share expenses, but you don't want the paychecks and such going into one bank account. There's lots of ways to get around this, but it's kind of the horse is usually out of the barn by the time the taxpayer gets to you. So you have to be very careful in a situation like this. And my advice is try to keep the husband out, but you may not be successful even on the top line, or definitely on the bottom line. The IRS is only going to allow half the expenses.
Okay.
You do the bankruptcy one.
Got it. Moving on to next question is from Paul. I'm sorry, you said you want to do the bankruptcy one instead?
Yeah. I think we need to get to the bankruptcy one before we run out of time.
Okay.
Because it ties in with the question that was just asked.
Thank you. So Rebecca is asking, if my client files for bankruptcy and has taxes discharged, will the IRS release the tax liens on real estate property?
The answer is no, but I'm going to give you a short course on dischargeability of taxes in bankruptcy here today. For those of you who know, bear with me. I'll try to make this brief. For those of you who don't, either attend our seminar or listen carefully. There are three rules. For dischargeability of income taxes, notice I didn't say payroll taxes, they're non-dischargeable. Dischargeability of income taxes in bankruptcy. The first and most generic rule is 3 years from the due date of the return, including extensions, income taxes are dischargeable in bankruptcy. So, a 2013 return filed on April 15th, the due date, whether it's filed before is irrelevant, or on October 15th, if on extension, is going to be dischargeable when? 2017, either October 16th or April 16th of 2017. That's 3 years. By the way, be careful. There are some tolling events, but we're not going to get into those today. We cover this, by the way, in our low-hanging fruit course. Easy way to make money, learn how to do a TDA, a tax dischargeability analysis. You're going to get somewhere between $1,000 and $5,000 for it, depending on the complexity. The second rule applies to delinquent returns. It's the 2-year rule. Goes like this. 2 years from the due date of the return, 2 years from the date the delinquent return was filed, income taxes are dischargeable in bankruptcy. When you get the IRS transcript, they will show you the filing date. Not the mailing date, not the received date, it's the filing date. So you must get the transcripts to verify this. So, let's take a delinquent return. You file a 2010 return in 2017. When is it dischargeable? 2 years from the date it was filed. So we're on the 1st of August here. On the 2nd of August of 2019, those delinquent returns, we don't have to wait 3 years for those. Then we have my favorite rule, the third rule for dischargeability of taxes in bankruptcy. It's the 240-day rule. Now, why is it my favorite rule? This is a really neat one. This applies to audits and amended returns. So your client gets audited, and the audit assessment comes down, and they owe $100,000 in tax. Now, of course, you must wait for the assessment to become final. But once that assessment is final, the clock starts ticking. 240 days later, you can file a bankruptcy. Now, let me give you a little twist. You got to be careful because the IRS is going to report the audit results to the state, right? So if you are contemplating a bankruptcy, you want to amend the state return right away, wait for it to be assessed, and wait for the assessment to become final. Start counting the 240 days from the state assessment date, not the federal assessment date, if you want both the federal and the state to be discharged. Story. Bankruptcy attorney refers me a case. Fortunately, he wasn't the one that filed the bankruptcy and inherited it. And clearly, the $250,000 in federal tax was discharged. It was 4 or 5 years old. So anyone looking at it and not digging in figured that both the federal and the state were dischargeable. Well, when the bankruptcy was discharged, we got a bill from the state of California for $50,000. Nobody could tell me why. So several thousand dollars in fees later, it turned out that the IRS audited the federal return. The taxpayer didn't amend his state return, waited for the IRS to send the audit results to the state. The state took 18 months. This process took 18 months. The state sent the notice of proposed assessment, the NPA, which didn't become final for 60 days. Remember, we have the 240-day rule, right? So the NPA becomes final, and the 240-day clock starts ticking. Bankruptcy attorney filed the case and filed the bankruptcy 6 weeks too early, committed malpractice, and cost the client $50,000. Do not let that practitioner be you. Remember, we're here for three reasons. We're here to teach you to make more money. Check out the low-hanging fruit class. Check out our offers and compromise and installment agreements class. Come to our 8-hour seminar. Get some CPE. Get the free stuff. Get the paid-for stuff. I don't care how you do it. But if you're going to work in this area, you need to do it. Don't commit malpractice. We're here to teach you how to make money. We're here to work with you on tax resolution cases. And we're here to become your trusted referral source. And we never steal your clients. We have time for another question or two. But the bankruptcy question is something that you really need to be versed in if you're going to be in this business. Sometimes it's the path of least resistance. If they qualify for a bankruptcy, there's a 99% chance the taxes are going to be discharged. With offers in compromise, even the most clear-cut ones, you're only maybe a 90-95% chance. I mean, 95% of the offers that we submit from this office are accepted. We know what the IRS is going to accept and what they're not going to accept. Typically, the only time we have any difficulty is when we get a surprise on something the client didn't tell us about, like that boat that they didn't list because they thought the IRS wouldn't find it in New Jersey. They will find it. Anyway, let's move on.
All right. So, Peter, we are going to go ahead and move on to people online asking questions. So please go ahead and submit them. We've already had several questions asked. So Julie is asking, what happens when both taxpayers die in the same year on a joint return and there's a balance due and the decedents have no monies?
You can't get blood from a stone and you can't get money from a dead person. If there are assets in the estate, the executor of the estate, whomever that might be, has to pay the tax liability. If there are no assets, don't pay it. It's over. You can't get money from a dead person. Simple answer.
All right. And then Robert is asking a question. When you were talking about filing returns and not being able to find information because they're so old, Robert has a strategy here and wants to know what you think about it. He said, would it be prudent to file a nominal amount on tax returns open beyond the 10-year time period and have the IRS adjust income per their files. So, for example, file the tax returns with the $5,000 of income and then have the IRS issue an adjustment to actual letter based on their available information.
Well, I don't think that's a bad idea. If you really want to try to cover those years that could come back and bite you because the statute of limitations never ran, I don't think it's a bad idea. The real question I have is, where are you getting the number from? I know you're talking about a nominal amount, and that seems to make sense to a practical person, and we do try to be practical. But if the taxpayer was an engineer or a lawyer or a CPA or a person that actually was earning money, I don't know that you can be so practical about it and just put $5,000 or $10,000 on the return, which, of course, as you know, is going to get eaten up by standard deduction and exemption and like that. I mean, it does get the statute of limitations going, and I guess if your longer-term strategy is to do an offer and compromise or something like that, then it might work. But also remember that you have self-employment tax that is going to accrue on any of that money that you list on the return. And I find it a little bit difficult to put a nominal amount on, depending on what the taxpayer did for a living, whether they had an education or not, what their employment history is, their age, and like that. So I'm a little bit on the fence. I know that's not the best answer, but that's the best I got, just like your suggestion of doing something nominal. I say let the IRS ask and file 7 years returns and go from there.
All right, George, is similar topic, but as it relates to offers and compromise, George is asking, if a taxpayer earns every year less than the requirement to file a 1040, for example, $14,000 for a married filing joint return, when the requirement is about $20,000, what do you answer on an offer and compromise when the IRS asks for all years to be filed before approving the offer?
That's very simple. It's the standard answer. The income was not sufficient, and taxpayer is not required to file. Sometimes the practical answer to that question is file the darn returns, because sometimes these revenue officers, these so-called offer specialists, remember, they're collectors. They don't know anything about assessment. So to sit there and try to explain it to them and have it hold up the offer, maybe the path of least resistance, you of course you're going to try by giving them the easy answer, which is the taxpayer's income was such that they were not required to file. You know, but remember, if they have interest income over a certain amount, they're required to file. If they have self-employment income over a certain amount, they're required to file. If they have a small W-2 with or without withholding, different story. Not required to file. So I think that it depends on the circumstances. Do try to explain it first, but if not, just surrender. In our 8-hour seminar, I tell probably a dozen stories, probably at least one short story an hour, on how the IRS has treated a certain item, whether it be on an offer and compromise, a bankruptcy situation, an installment agreement, a partial pay installment agreement, a 4180 interview, and like that. And you'll see what I mean when I say that much of the time there's no 100% correct answer in the collection business. Remember, preparing returns is a science at some level, but collection is an art. We actually have a seminar, IRS audits, are they art or are they science? Should check that one out. We do that periodically on Tax Tuesdays for free as well.
All right, I think we have time for one more question, Peter. This is related to bankruptcy. So Stuart is asking, client just had some taxes survive his personal bankruptcy because they are recent years, 2015 and 16. I want to submit an offering and compromise for him. The surviving taxes are about $12,000, but he discharged about $40,000. Through the BK, he proved his insolvency. Will the IRS expedite the offer because of this? Anything I should look out for?
Well, let me talk about the offer process. There's no expedite on it. You know, depending on where your taxpayer is located, the 433A OIC, the corresponding 656, are prepared, and they're sent to either Memphis, Tennessee, or Holtsville, New York. 4 to 6 months later, they come back. They land on a revenue officer's desk, a so-called offer specialist. And when it comes to the top of the pile, they re-document all of what you submitted. Which brings me to, your fees must be pretty low if you're going to do an offer for $12,000. Because these offers are time intensive, and I would almost never do an offer for a $12,000 outstanding liability. I would do an installment agreement of $150, $200 a month and just be done with it. But, you know, everybody's fees are different. Everybody's thought process, maybe it's a family member. Everybody's thought process is different. The insolvency is not going to expedite the offer. And obviously these taxes were outside the 3-year period. I want to address another question that came in because we skipped over it, and it ties in with the bankruptcy. It ties in with offers. I'm going to give you the short answer to this question, but it's important because it was submitted, and I'd like to try to get to all of the questions that were submitted. The question was, what happens if you have an unreasonable revenue officer? Well, that's simple. You appeal it. There's a special appeals form for offers in compromise. We actually have a course which we do periodically on Tax Tuesdays, which we cover in our 8-hour seminar on appeals, all kinds of appeals, everything from offers in compromise to tax audits to tax court to fast track mediation and so on. In this case, if you fail at the basic level with the revenue officer, the offer specialist, and you fail because the appeals officer is also unreasonable, and it has happened. I tell several stories in our 8-hour seminar on this issue. You can appeal to the tax court. You can petition the tax court. But the difference between this kind of petition and a normal petition to the tax court, which we do at least once a month, and we talk about why we do it. We have no intention of going to tax court. We talk about all that in our 8-hour seminar. The underlying tax liability is not the issue. So the tax court review is for abuse of discretion. So if you have someone like my buddy David Snyder in appeals at the IRS that comes up with that abuses his discretion, we appeal those kind of things to the tax court. It is not an appeal or a petition that we normally do when we want to get a third bite at the apple and have a more reasonable IRS counsel who has more discretion, who has more leeway, and who takes the hazards of litigation much more seriously than the IRS appeals person does. They say they're supposed to take the hazards of litigation into account, but trust me, they don't in anywhere near the way general counsel does where they schedule for tax court and they schedule the pretrial conference. You should try that sometime. It works actually the best. You get your third bite at the apple, and you'll be very successful even in getting rid of that 20% penalty. We talk about that more in our 8-hour seminar. I can't say it enough. We're here to teach you how to make more money. We're here to work with you on your tax resolution cases or to become your trusted referral source. Again, my name is Peter Steffen. I hope you got something out of the hour today. Thanks, and I'm going to sign off from TRI.
Thank you guys for participating. Just a reminder, our next call is going to be on September 5th, so please go ahead and register for that, and please take advantage of Peter's offer. It is limited time, and I will be sending you guys a follow-up email to remind you of that. Thank you all. Talk again next month.